Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
This is The Takeaway for Tuesday, February 20th, 2018.
There were new indictments late last week from Robert Mueller's special counsel investigation into Russian interference in the 2016 elections. The indictments aren't money laundering or lying to the FBI, and the targets aren't American.
A grand jury in the District of Columbia today returned an indictment presented by the special counsel's office. The indictment charges 13 Russian nationals and three Russian companies for committing federal crimes while seeking to interfere in the United States political system, including the 2016 presidential election.
Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein speaking to the press on Friday there. The indictments paint a vivid picture of a group of Russian nationals working to foment divisions in American culture and influence the 2016 election in favor of candidate Donald Trump.
The defendants allegedly conducted what they called information warfare against the United States, with the stated goal of spreading distrust towards the candidates and the political system in general.
Investigators don't allege that the operation changed the outcome of the election, and President Trump saw that as total vindication and tweeted about it all weekend. But this latest round of charges isn't Robert Mueller's last say in this investigation. This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. Betsy Woodruff joins us often to talk about the Mueller investigation. She's a political reporter for The Daily Beast.
The indictments lay out essentially an intelligence operation that more than a dozen Russian individuals spearheaded from Russia, designed to influence the outcome of the United States election and also to sow what they described as quote-unquote political intensity. Basically, they were hoping to make Americans feel more angry, more divided, less trusting in the government. And it seems like, you know, based on looking back at how things played out in 2016, there was more than enough of that to go around.
So, Betsy, what's the larger plan here? Robert Mueller must have known that charging these Russians and Russian companies probably wouldn't bring them in front of U.S. courts. They're not going to be extradited. So what's the goal here?
What Robert Mueller is doing in this particular indictment is something that cybersecurity experts call attribution. When people in the cybersecurity space talk about how to stave off hacking or other disruptive acts, including what the Russians did during our presidential election, one of the most effective tools that they have is demonstrating which individual people in a hostile country or group took which specific actions that had what specific impacts in the United States. When American cybersecurity officials and law enforcement officials can show exactly how these Russian efforts play out, it can dramatically reduce their ability to be effective. If people know that it's Russian meddlers rather than, for instance, as the president once joked, a 400-pound guy in his mom's basement, rather than actual Tea Party or Black Lives Matter activists, then they can be much more savvy when they're viewing these communications. So just the fact that Mueller was able to track out in this level of detail the way the Russian efforts worked is itself a really important accomplishment. That said, obviously, it comes much too late to be a deterrent for the 2016 presidential, obviously, but it is something that could make things more challenging or at least prove to be a shot across the bow for future Russian efforts or efforts by other bad actors to try to put their thumbs on the scale in American elections.
And in terms of the direction of the Mueller investigation itself, Betsy, there's been a lot of speculation and even some evidence in public view that members of the Trump campaign and the Trump transition met or conversed with Russians. Would Robert Mueller potentially be trying in the future to show connections between these indicted Russians from Friday and Americans in the election and the transition, or are those different groups of people?
One thing that Mueller pointed out in the indictment, one thing he said, is that there were multiple officials on the Trump campaign who actually received communications from people, Russians, who were working in this internet research agency. Now, the Mueller indictment made very clear, the indictment did not include any evidence that those campaign officials knew that it was Russians who were reaching out to them. The indictment itself did not include any evidence that there was coordination or collusion or witting cooperation between the Trump campaign and the Kremlin. That said, this is one indictment. There could be more indictments coming down the track. And I know people don't like to hear this, but it may just be a case of wait and see to see what he ultimately ends up finding.
Well, Betsy, the president isn't playing wait and see. He was all over Twitter all weekend. The president said he's vindicated by all this, that these indictments show there was no collusion, no effect on the election. Is he vindicated by all this?
You know, that's not really correct. The fact that Bob Mueller handed out an indictment and you weren't named in it is not necessarily cause for celebration. I also was not on Twitter celebrating the fact that I wasn't named in Bob Mueller's indictment. That said, there's clearly a significant amount of anxiety in the White House every time that Mueller gets close to handing down a new indictment.
Betsy Woodruff reporting on the Mueller investigation for the Daily Beast. Betsy, thanks as always.
Sure thing.
The Russian individuals and organizations that Robert Mueller indicted last week, and probably many, many others who aren't in that indictment, have a lot of tools in their campaign influencing toolkit. Social media bots are a big one. Automated accounts swarming over Twitter and popping up in news feeds on Facebook, multiplying and amplifying the message that their programmers want to get out there. The Release the Memo campaign a couple weeks ago, remember that, helped House Republicans try to discredit the Mueller investigation. That was pushed in part by bots. Intelligence chiefs warned Congress that Russians are not done interfering in U.S. politics and that their bots are still lurking social media trying to do just that. Molly McHugh is an expert on information warfare and the narrative architect at New Media Frontier, and she studies the trail from automated tweets to congressional action.
There are so many different bot structures underlying the architecture of social media now that in almost any big story, you will see automated content being promoted. The simplest way to define the two biggest groups is sort of left and right. There's kind of the Bernie bots and or the resist bots. And on the other side, there's kind of the alt-right, far-right group. But it's not always quite so simple as that. But on the Release the Memo case that you mentioned, there were a lot of automated structures that were promoting the hashtag and content relating to the hashtag. And sort of the narrative around it, this idea of the FBI being a bad actor in American society. With the school shooting in Florida, there has been a lot of bot activity on this story from both sides, one very much anti-gun, the other sort of from the opposite side, the liberals are trying to take your guns away. But from both columns of automation, there's been a lot of content promoted over the last couple of days.
So this is to say that whenever there's a big salient news event in American politics or on the American scene, the bots come out pretty much right away from the extremes.
Absolutely.
And why are they there? What purpose are they serving? I mean, presumably, most Americans know what they think about guns or gun control. What are the bots trying to do?
So I think the best way to think about the automation structures in social media is that they are meant to amplify or create the perception that a view is more prevalent than it is. That is why these campaigns can be so effective if they are done well, because that's the point of them. It is not to open your mind to new ideas. It is to harden your views and get you completely activated behind a concept. And the core of most of these structures, it's not born from propaganda, it starts as marketing. Botnets were originally built as ways to promote advertising and sort of make money off of advertising. But of course, once those structures evolve and exist, it's very easy to use them for different purposes.
So talk about the marketing of ideas then when it comes to politics. I mean, a couple of weeks ago or over the last 6 weeks, when the storyline around the Republican memo in the Intelligence Committee and Chairman Devin Nunes and his activity was building up, there was this debate about whether hashtag release the memo came from humans in America or came from Russians, sort of the idea of whether it was legitimate or not. What was that debate really about, and did it matter?
It does matter. And it's an interesting question, but it absolutely matters. And I think it's the problem is that depending on which perspective you're arguing from, you want the answer to be it's Russians who are telling us this, or it's crazy people that are telling us this, or none of it is real, or all of it is real. And it's the combination of those things. Within the Release the Memo campaign, there were absolutely Russian bots, there were non-Russian bots, there were real humans who were just regular Joes on the internet. So it was kind of the layering on of all of these different things, of sort of the real and the fake and the machine and the human, that made the campaign so effective. And what made it gain amplification much quicker is that they very effectively got this in front of verified accounts. So, you know, far right media personalities and others who are not main, it's not Hannity, it's not the main people yet. But in the early phase of the campaign, there were verified accounts on Twitter that picked it up, started promoting it, got that to mainstream right media. And then there was, once Hannity and Trump's son and congressman started echoing the hashtag and the talking points, it became a very real thing for a specific slice of the media environment of the country. It's not that everybody is sitting on Twitter and that everybody sees these things and that everybody is then convinced by them. And often you hear arguments like that being made from some academics from the side of social media companies, sort of very skeptically saying, come on, you know, only 8% of these ads got to these people, so none of it had any impact on anything. But that doesn't really matter. It's the little piece that is the activation potential that can be churned up pretty quickly by some of these campaigns. It doesn't always work, but when it does work, it's extremely effective because it is about moving a fringe view or narrative from the sort of gray space of digital media world into real media. And once it gets there, it becomes a real thing, regardless of where it came from.
Well, Molly, look, I'm a major proponent of free speech, and I'm going to be the first guy to probably oppose you if you say that people shouldn't be on Twitter, even if they're lying. But bots don't have a right to free speech. You know, Twitter is an American company. Why not shut down the bots? Why not say, hey, real people, you can have all the Twitter accounts you want. No bots.
Well, this is exactly the point, is that there are these aspects built into these social media platforms that allow for computational propaganda to be used against people. And again, it can be for marketing something or it can be for selling ideas. And I think this is the thing that's so critical. Yes, people have their views. Yes, people are allowed to promote their views. We may not agree with all of those views. Certainly, that is never going to be the case. But do people have the right to use data-driven, AI-supported computational propaganda against their fellow citizens in order to convince them of things that nobody else really believes? I don't know what the answer is to that. I'd like to say no, but I think we really need to look at it more clearly and without the rose-colored glasses on and absent the sort of First Amendment Trump's all attitude that I think the social media companies have really tried to leverage. And you saw it after the Release the Memo campaign, where the initial response from Twitter to inquiries from the Congress about what was behind this campaign on Twitter was, no, it was Republicans. You know, everybody has the right to say what they want. But this naivete that's continually put forward, like, oh, we had no idea, it's our first day, they know exactly what they're talking about. This is why they wrote the algorithms the way they did. Social media works exactly the way it is supposed to, which is to keep you within a narrow view echo chamber world so that you stay engaged on the platform and they can make more money off of you and harvest more data from you and sell that for additional money. And this whole cycle is creating a completely corrosive information environment that has absolutely nothing to do with news or information or media or truth in ways that we are used to thinking about it. And when you get into these evaluations of, well, people don't really believe political advertising, so none of this stuff in 2016 mattered, we weren't seeing political ads. You were seeing content promoted from supposed people that were arguing specific views that had nothing to do with a labeled campaign or a PAC or anything else. And that does have a very different impact. When people think other people believe these views, it changes the way that they view them.
Molly McHugh, narrative architect at New Media Frontier. Molly, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Well, we just heard from Molly McHugh there all about computational propaganda. It is being used to try to subvert American democracy. But another question here is, what's the real effect of all this? Bots do sow divisions online, but are they actually changing votes?
there's much less evidence that brief encounters with a single political message can change people's minds in a durable way. We have to be really careful about just assuming that these stories, these ads, these fake news websites were just transforming people's minds. That's not an experience I think that most people had.
That's Brendan Nyhan. He's a professor in the Department of Government at Dartmouth College. He says bots and fake news are a problem in our politics, but he says when it comes to actual elections, the effect isn't at all clear.
I'm not saying we shouldn't be worried about it. We should be, but I think we should be worried about it for the right reasons and based on solid data. What I'm concerned about is people making loose suggestions that fake news changed the 2016 election outcome, for instance, which is something that's not consistent with what we know about how hard it is to change people's opinions, as well as the data we have on who actually went to these websites.
Well, what's some of the best research that you have, some of the best data that's driving the skepticism for you?
Well, there's a whole bunch of research in political science, which is my field, showing that persuasion in campaigns is very difficult. And when people try to change people's minds and change who they'll vote for, it typically fails. And so we should be skeptical of the idea that seeing an article on Facebook for 7 or 10 seconds might have systematically changed the votes of thousands and thousands of people. That intuition is reinforced by the data that my co-authors, Andrew Guest and Jason Reifler and I collected, where we actually were able to observe the websites that people visited. And we found that visits to fake news websites were overwhelmingly concentrated among the set of people who already had extremely conservative information diets. But I think we have to be careful to calibrate our concerns using data and to think about the effects of fake news in this more precise way that I'm proposing.
Give me a sense of what it really does take to change minds in politics. You've been pretty clear, and you're not the first one, Brendan, to say it's really, really hard to change a mind in the political world. What does it take when it's successful?
You know, I don't know if we have a broad answer to that. In some cases, it's the world out there that changes in a way that people ultimately aren't able to deny, right? So you could think about, for instance, the economy being good in the late period of the Clinton administration when Bill Clinton's approval ratings were increasing and even Republicans were acknowledging the economy was quite good. Or you can think about the public turning against a war in Iraq as it became clear that an insurgency was growing there.
Right. So let's move away then from the idea of changing the minds of an independent voter in Iowa to a real world example, Release the Memo, which we just saw on the American scene over the last month or two. That wasn't about changing votes, but it was certainly about something politically salient and pushing lawmakers and the president into a position that people programming bots and driving news, in some cases fake news, or at least with a political agenda, was able to achieve.
That's an example of the more subtle kind of argument you could make about how bots and fake news and other kinds of strategies like this might affect our politics. We find in our research that visits to fake news websites were driven by Facebook. Twitter is not a mass medium in the same way that Facebook is, but it is an effective way to reach political elites and media elites, and in that way potentially have some effect on the national conversation or their actions. And again, we need to carefully differentiate the different players in this sphere. The fake news websites that we analyzed in our study are, to the best of our understanding, created by entrepreneurs who are trying to make money. The Facebook and ad networks created a very attractive market opportunity for those folks. Some of these bot efforts are seemingly organized by folks with explicitly political goals. There's no profit motive. It may be Russian-affiliated agents or others who have some kind of an agenda. And that, again, is going to present a different set of problems and potentially a different set of solutions than the fake news that's just trying to make money.
Is it even knowable whether Russian meddling moved votes, changed minds, or changed the outcome?
It's a very difficult question to answer. Any single counterfactual like that is inherently unknowable in some sense. We can use tools of social science to try to understand what might have happened, right? So our study, for instance, allows us to say that the data we observe are inconsistent with visits to fake news websites being especially persuasive in changing vote choice. The Russian hacking is more complicated. You have to think about what might have happened if the Podesta email hadn't been hacked and if that hadn't changed the news agenda in the period before the election. And that's a much harder counterfactual to evaluate, right? It's not that many people were actually downloading the emails, but it was shaping the news agenda in a way that may have been important.
I want to take one final example from just this week, and it doesn't have much to do with moving votes in an election. Fake news accounts have been stating over the last day or two, and bots have been amplifying, that white people are getting assaulted at showings of the new movie Black Panther. It's not true. But when you see that kind of activity on social media, what do you see?
Well, I'm worried. I'm worried that the fake news entrepreneurs out there are incredibly strategic about chasing what performs to make money. It's a terrible situation where we've created these tools that can make it very profitable to inflame us and turn us against each other. I don't know what systematic effects that has, but I do think that people need to be held accountable, particularly at the platforms that have made disseminating that kind of content so profitable and attractive. There will be a trade-off financially for the platforms. Twitter, if it cracked down on bots, its user statistics would look less attractive. If Facebook moves away from pushing news in its newsfeed to more friends and family content and people use the platform less, that could hurt its bottom line as well. That's why it's essential for civil society to keep up the pressure on the platforms to act in socially responsible ways. It will take systematic pressure from the outside to make sure that their arguments win out when it conflicts with those companies' bottom lines.
Brendan Nyhan, professor in the Department of Government at Dartmouth College. Brendan, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
That howling chorus you're hearing there is a pack of red wolves, and sadly, it's a sound you soon may not be able to hear in America ever again. There are only 45 to 60 red wolves left in the wild in the United States. Red wolves once ranged the eastern part of the country from Pennsylvania to Florida and as far away as Texas, but now there's only one place where you can hear those howls. On one wildlife refuge in North Carolina. Federal wildlife officials started introducing pairs of red wolves into the refuge 30 years ago. Their numbers climbed at first, but now red wolves are once again close to extinction. The whole episode is viewed by many conservationists as a failure of the Endangered Species Act. With more from North Carolina is Delene Beeland. She's a science and nature writer and author of The Secret World of the Red Wolves. Delene, thanks for being here.
Oh, thank you very much.
Delene, it's a sad story. There was an effort, as I said, to reintroduce captive bred wolves into the Alligator River Refuge in North Carolina. Their numbers climbed to over 200, and now they might be below just 45 individuals. What happened?
It's definitely a long story, but I wouldn't qualify it as all sad as you were leading in. I think there's been many successes with this program, despite the recent decline. The red wolves first began dwindling throughout the 1800s and early 1900s to where there was just one last population in the wild in eastern Texas and western Louisiana. And right around the time the Endangered Species Act was passed in 1973, biologists had already turned their attention to saving the last red wolves in the wild. Unfortunately, by the time they really started digging into it, the red wolves were already interbreeding with coyotes in the wild. And Curtis Carley, who was a Fish and Wildlife Service biologist tasked with recovering the red wolves in the wild, realized they couldn't do it in the wild. He had to basically convince his superiors that they were going to have to capture the last wild red wolves, captive breed them, and reintroduce them into the wild later. And I think it's important for us to look at the history of science and understand at this time, nobody was doing that. It seems so commonplace now to say, well, we can captive breed it and reintroduce it. But the red wolf was the very first time that we did this with an animal in the United States of America. And I think that in itself is a huge success that they did this. The recent decline with red wolves, I would qualify as largely a political failure, not a biological one.
Well, the Endangered Species Act is in place to help with situations just like this, to protect threatened species in the United States. You say mostly a political failure, not a biological one. Explain that.
So many people see the Fish and Wildlife Service as sort of this, you know, monolithic agency tasked with recovering and saving and managing wild animals. But there's a lot of different layers to the Fish and Wildlife Service. And what I saw when I was researching and reporting my book, The Secret World of Red Wolves, is that the field team, the field biologists who work on the ground, you know, boots on the ground, trying to save these animals, working with the policy regulations that they have, and then their own cunning in many ways, they were so dedicated to saving this animal and doing everything they could to reach the recovery goals that were spelled out in the Red Wolf Recovery Program. And one of those goals was to have 3 wild populations that numerically had enough to continue 80 to 90% of the red wolf's genes, you know, 150 years into the future. That was their goal. And then there's different management actions that, you know, can carry them to that goal. But the field team was, in many ways, I think, let down by the bureaucratic Southeastern Regional Atlanta office of the Fish and Wildlife Service. You know, it's divvied up into regions. And at the regional level, I don't feel that the Fish and Wildlife Service field team was adequately supported. And because there was some, I would qualify it as a small but vocal minority of landowners that began agitating against the program, at the regional level, the Fish and Wildlife Service began to take actions that basically prevented the field team from being able to carry out their goal of recovering the red wolf in the wild.
You say landowners. There were landowners in the area who didn't want red wolves on their land or thought they were threatening their property.
Right, yes, within the Red Wolf Recovery Area. And it's also important to note, you know, in the beginning you described red wolves were first reintroduced into Alligator River National Wildlife Refuge, and that's true. It was September of 1987, September 14th, I believe, when 4 pairs were first released there. But since 1987, over the course of this program, red wolves came to occupy 1.5 million acres over the entire Albemarle Peninsula. It's a 5-county area that is now the Red Wolf Recovery Area. And if you look at a map of North Carolina, that peninsula is kind of a finger-like, thumb-like projection of land that juts out into the V of the Outer Banks. So it's not just the refuge that's involved. It's actually a much, much greater area. And the field team, the field biologists, did a wonderful job, I think, of working one-on-one with many different landowners to reach the recovery goals of having red wolves in the wild. And working one-on-one, a lot of times with verbal agreements with landowners to manage red wolves on their land. So I think it would be unfair to characterize it as many, many, all these landowners that are upset, because many were working quite well with the Fish and Wildlife Service Agency, the field team, up until just a couple years ago.
Delene, less than 45 individuals now. What's the hope for the future of red wolves?
I think there's still lots of reasons to hope. You know, the Fish and Wildlife Service was supposed to come out with a decision last October as to where the program is going to go from here. They essentially stopped all management actions about 2 years ago, and we've all been waiting to find out what the next steps will be. But I think that one of the legacies of the Red Wolf, there's several firsts that came out of this program in terms of wildlife management techniques. And I hope that the legacy won't end with that, with the contributions that the Red Wolf's management has made to wildlife biology in general. I hope that it will continue, because I think that there's plenty of room for people and red wolves in eastern North Carolina, and probably in other areas in the Southeast too.
Delene Beeland, author of The Secret World of Red Wolves. Delene, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Let's go to Pennsylvania now, because Pennsylvania has a new electoral map, and it could give Democrats a boost in their hopes of winning back the House in November. The Pennsylvania State Supreme Court released a new congressional district map on Monday. This was just weeks after ruling that the map the Commonwealth used for 3 election cycles was gerrymandered in favor of Republicans and unconstitutional. Now, we did a deep dive on gerrymandering and its power to silence millions of voters on the show on Friday. If you missed it, you should definitely download the podcast of Friday's show. It's called Drawn Out. But let's go to Pennsylvania now. With me now to explain this new map and what it means is Katie Meyer from WITF's Capitol Bureau in Harrisburg. Hi, Katie.
Hi.
Well, Katie, the court has issued its decision. What does Pennsylvania's map look like now?
So I'll say the old map was, you know, heavily favored Republicans. About 5 seats were consistently won by Democrats in the last 3 elections, and that's out of 18. The new map is, I think, really intentionally drawn to try to mitigate the effects of that gerrymandering. And so we're roughly estimating it would probably give Democrats between 8 and 11 seats. Now, I will note, Pennsylvania is a really sort of striated state, so Democrats just largely live in the cities. So it's actually really difficult to represent them properly. We have more registered Democrats, but it's hard to get all of those votes to count as much. So a lot of Republicans are pretty upset about this map, saying it's a Democratic gerrymander because it's so clearly drawn with the intention of making the districts even.
And a lot of the Democrats are concentrated in the big cities, Philly and Pittsburgh, on 2 other ends of the states, and a lot of the Republicans in between in that vast middle of Pennsylvania. Katie, the takeaway went to 2 districts in Pennsylvania a couple weeks ago, the 6th district and the 7th district, 2 heavily gerrymandered districts tucked in the southeastern corner of the Commonwealth. What's happened to those 2 districts?
So it's actually really interesting. It's difficult to do a number-to-number comparison because part of what the Supreme Court did is they totally renumbered everything. And so the districts that are now what the 6th and 7th were, they look much more compact, more contiguous as per the court's order. And you do see, though, you see some municipal splitting. You see some, towns kind of being pulled out of, you know, the communities where they had been previously, just in a bid to get Democrats a few more votes. It looks less snake-like and twisty than the previous map did. But, that's not always a good indicator of like what people are doing. So I think it's a map that was very intentionally drawn to maximize Democratic votes in certain areas.
We've been spending a lot of time looking at the math of gerrymandering, not necessarily the shape of districts. We're going to talk about that next as well. Katie, let's step back. Big picture. Democrats need 24 pickups to try to take back the House in November. That's going to be about the popularity of Donald Trump. That's going to be about a number of things. But what does the map changing in Pennsylvania mean to that whole effort? I mean, you said that Democrats could get 8 or 10 or 11 seats instead of their normal 5.
Yeah. And so, I mean, that's big, especially for a big Republican swing state. I suppose I can't even call it a Republican state like Pennsylvania. I think it's, you can't overstate that this is a significant thing. However, I mean, you know, and I know the House is large. So 5 seats, while Democrats are going to look at that and be like, awesome, you know, it's not going to flip the House over.
Probably won't flip the House over, but 24 seats, and this might lower the bar for Democrats trying to take back the House. Meanwhile, Republicans in Pennsylvania say this might cause a constitutional crisis, and they're pledging to take this map back to court. This fight may not be over. Katie Meyer from WITF, my childhood public radio station in central Pennsylvania. Katie, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Political redistricting is complicated and contentious. Just listen to what's going on in Pennsylvania. It might have you wondering, isn't there an easier way to do all this? It seems obvious at first, just make districts proportional. Now, the math of proportionality is pretty easy to get your head around. If 40% of voters in a state are Republicans, say, then about 40% of lawmakers elected to the House from that state should also be Republican. That seems fair intuitively, but the mathematicians who understand elections say not so fast. At least in our system of government, proportionality wouldn't be fair at all. Mira Bernstein is here to explain. She's a member of the Metric Geometry and Gerrymandering Group at Tufts University.
I think this is one of the most unexpected things that comes up when I give talks to people. I've given talks to audiences from high school students to, you know, League of Women Voters to scientists. And except for political scientists, everybody is surprised at this fact. You know, I ask people if a party got 55% of the votes, what percent of the seats should it get? And everybody says 55, and they have no idea that our system is not actually built for that. So let me give you a few examples of why that wouldn't necessarily happen. One example is my own home state of Massachusetts. In Massachusetts, reliably about 30% of voters vote Republican, let's say in presidential elections. We have 9 congressional districts. So you would expect, if it followed the idea of fairness that most people have, so we have about a third of our voters are Republicans, so a third of our districts should be Republicans. But it's been a long time since there's been a Republican congressional district in Massachusetts. All 9 of our districts are Democratic and have been Democratic for a while and will remain Democratic for a while. So I've heard people say, oh, clearly Massachusetts is gerrymandered. Because why don't you have Republican districts? But the fact is, it turns out that there are very, very few places in Massachusetts where Republicans are a majority. So there are lots of Republicans, but they all live among the Democrats. So if you were going to make a Republican majority district, even if you were a Republican legislature somehow miraculously appeared in Massachusetts and tried to create a Republican district, they couldn't, because there's just not enough places in the state where Republicans outnumber Democrats. This is one way you already see where the winner-take-all system, you know, in every district, the Republicans get ignored. And the winner-take-all system creates 100% Democratic delegation. So that's one way that you can get lack of proportionality. A different way is actually with competitive districts. So it's very funny because when I talk to people about what is their ideals for democracy. So one thing they always say is some kind of proportionality. And the other thing is people always say, we want competitive districts. We want competition. We don't want safe districts for, you know, where politicians won't be held accountable. But if you think about it, let's say you have a state with 10 competitive districts, right? So all the districts are roughly 50-50. So let's say, as it happens in the current election, 80% of the districts go to the Democrats. So 8 of the 10 districts go to the Democrats and 2 of the districts go to Republicans. Then the vote percentage is still about 50-50. Maybe it's 51 in favor of Democrats. But now the Democrats got 8 out of 10 districts. So in competitive elections, a very small change in the percent of people voting can make a huge difference in the percent of the seats the party gets.
Shouldn't a state, the people drawing the map, try to get close to the ideal of proportionality, even if it's not going to work out every time? There's no guarantee in any given election or certainly in any district. But shouldn't the driving motivation when drawing a map to get close to an idea of proportionality?
So that is certainly one thing you can ask the legislatures to do. You can pass a law that says that the legislature should try to draw the districts so that the expected number of Republican and Democratic districts is roughly proportional. Here's what you lose that way. First of all, you lose competitive elections. The only way to draw such a map is to draw safe districts. So in other words, you can gerrymander for proportionality. And in fact, there was a Supreme Court case in the 70s where I think it was Connecticut actually did gerrymander for proportionality. But they did it basically as a bipartisan gerrymander to make things safe for incumbents. So actually, politicians love gerrymandering for proportionality. California was doing it for a long time because the way to do that is to make safe districts, and they don't mind having safe districts. And the Supreme Court said that they deviated a little bit from equal population of the districts in that plan in order to make it proportional. And so the lawsuit claimed that they deviated from something that's constitutionally required for an illegitimate reason, which is an incumbent favoring gerrymandering. And the Supreme Court said, no, you can deviate from that for the sake of proportionality. In other words, proportionality is a goal that you can strive for if you want, but lack of proportionality does not constitute a violation.
Mira Bernstein is a member of the Metric Geometry and Gerrymandering Group at Tufts University. The landmark Supreme Court case, Loving versus Virginia, in 1967, barred states from banning interracial marriage. And a generation of American children born to a black and a white parent is the focus of a new 4-part documentary series called The Loving Generation. It's out now on Topic.com. Directors Lacey Schwartz and Marette Mandefro explore the lives of biracial children born between the mid-60s and the mid-80s, including WNYC's Rebecca Carroll, who spoke with Lacey Schwartz about the series and about her own thoughts on the Loving Generation.
A lot of times I think the conversation around biracial identity is around individuals' identities versus having the conversation within a larger societal context and having a conversation where individuals who do in fact have one black and one white identified parent, talking about their experience, but talking about it also in a larger context. And I think that's the important piece for me, is to analyze ourselves as not just these individuals who are in fact struggling with our own day-to-day experiences, but is actually looking at a larger context and not necessarily even answering the questions around it, but being able to ask them in that context.
And so you mentioned the sort of day-to-day struggle. I mean, I think that for me, I'm done struggling. Like I sort of spent a lot of time navigating what it meant to be of mixed race, but also clearly looking Black, and then sort of coming to a place of just, I'm just Black. And so when you mention the struggles, what kind of struggles did you hear or see in the series?
I'm kind of like where you are as well. I feel like, you know, I've kind of thankfully worked through my struggle and come to the other end, and sometimes struggles about identity, but also sometimes, you know, struggle is really about family, mm-hmm. as is my case, you know, and sometimes it is about race and sometimes it's about community, and it can be many different things. And in an ideal world, a lot of us work through this and get to a place where we're still on the journey, obviously, but the struggle gets easier. This series actually takes place with people reflecting on what was a struggle for them at various points. And obviously not everybody has the same struggles. I think for those of us like yourself, like myself, who have in fact really engaged with their struggle and come out the other end, there's some really important insights that come out of that.
These ideas that you and I have engaged deeply in, oftentimes our families don't. Mm-hmm. So maybe you could speak a little bit to your own personal experience with your family in this project.
Similar to yourself, I had two white parents. I still do have two white parents. And, you know, your interview really affected me in a very personal level because I think there's a lot of similarities. We both grew up in rural Northeast with two white parents, and we both biologically come from a white parent and a Black parent. So there was a lot, I think, about your experience that very much resonated with me. And I think, you know, I made a personal documentary, and like yourself, I did a lot of work digging into my own story, my own family secrets, and my own identity. And I was able to connect with so many incredible people, including yourself, including Anna Holmes. Although many of us did, as we said, identify as being Black, although not all of us, we really wanted to just include people who were able to speak in a very, very honest and authentic way about their own experience, have some historical context to add to it, and be able to analyze it as such.
You mentioned Anna Holmes, who is an executive producer of the series, and Anna recently wrote an op-ed for the New York Times titled Black with, parentheses, some white privilege. And it should be mentioned, because it really matters, that Anna, who is also biracial, is very light-skinned. She writes about proximity to whiteness and her ease moving among and around white people, and also that President Obama was likely buoyed in some way by his white family, and that's what gave him some of the confidence, if not all, to be president. So this piece in the Times talks a lot about and centers kind of whiteness and proximity to whiteness and what that does for us if we are biracial. What that points to is, for example, you know, I have two sets of parents, a Black birth father and a white birth mother. And then I have two white adoptive parents. And because I look Black and I also Black identify, when I'm out in the world or applying for jobs or driving my car or whatever, none of that matters. My proximity to whiteness means nothing. But even more important, I don't want or need it to mean anything. And so, you know, my response has been, as a biracial person, to almost wholly divest from whiteness.
I cannot agree with you more about the fact that whiteness is centered and is fundamentally normative. And people of color in general, but certainly Black people, it's like every day, every moment, have been having to center whiteness all the time in their lives, and are just have to work through that, and are just, many people are just done with that. And so how do you orient yourself as an individual to actually not have to, in fact, center whiteness? I completely agree with, and I think that that is a process, and one of the things we try to show in the third episode is that journey that some of our participants in this series actually went through, of kind of coming of age in that and then moving past that.
One other point that Anna mentioned in her piece was that she grew up feeling a kind of ease in and around white people. It made me think of when my son was probably 4 or 5 and we were in New Hampshire visiting my parents where I grew up. And my son turned to me and he's like, why is everybody white here? And I realized, and I sort of written about this and I wrote in a piece, you know, that I didn't find my people until I had my son. And my mom was really upset about that because she felt like, well, I'm your people, we're your people. And they're not. They are actually not, which doesn't mean I don't love them. It doesn't mean that they're not my parents.
But in terms of my people, you know, I've never felt like white people are my people. I've never felt that kind of ease of proximity. I've always felt othered in my experience growing up. Do you feel an ease of proximity, an ease around white people?
You know, I mean, your question reminds me of like when Little White Lie came out, and my mother did do a lot of press with me around it, and she shared a story actually when we sat down with the New York Times to do our first story, and she shared a story which I actually really appreciated about the first time she ever heard me do an interview. I guess I had done some radio thing or something, and she was listening to it online, and I identified as being black. And she talked very honestly about how it felt like a knife into her stomach. And she had never shared that with me, but she was sharing it honestly about how she, at the time, really actually like checked herself and realized that like I was something other than what she was. And it was like her awakening into that and having to work through that and really do the work. And I think one of the, you know, many things with the process of Little White Lie was I very much grew up in a family that kind of at moments said, oh, you're just like us. You're one of us. And they, I don't know if they were consciously talking about race or they were just, you know, being like, oh, your personality, or, you know, they weren't consciously thinking about it. But part of the process, I think, of doing that project, even off camera, was working with my mother around racial consciousness and gaining a racial consciousness that has been, I think, a very positive experience for the both of us. And because that is really the way I look at it in terms of, like you, as you said, your mother being taken aback by your story, is that I think for my mother, she had to go through her own process of accepting the differences between us. And I had to work through being able to have those conversations honestly with my family as well. Because, and you know, you and I, you know, I think partnering is obviously something you and I have talked about extensively as well, is like, how do we be who we are, mm-hmm. you know, outside of how we orient ourselves to our, whether or not it's our biological family or the family who raised us or to our partner, and just be who we are and have our identity be who we are, versus like in relationship to our parents or our partner or whatever it is. So I definitely feel you.
Lacey Schwartz, thank you so much.
Thank you.
WNYC's Rebecca Carroll talking with Lacey Schwartz, the co-director, producer, and writer of the documentary series Loving Generation. That's our show for today. You can hear more on our podcast. You can always find it on iTunes, the TuneIn app, wherever you get your pods. In the meantime, thanks so much for being with us today. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Babbel, offering a language program that uses interactive dialogue and speech recognition technology to teach a new language, like Spanish, French, and Italian. Babbel is available in the App Store or online at babbel.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.